Thank you so much for joining us. Not only did the conference get Sally last night, but we have a twofer. We're pretty lucky.
Lucky people.
So as you all know, this talk is about optimism. And you came to the right place if you're excited to focus on the positive today. Just wanted to start off with who I am, and then so honored to introduce Sally. So my name's Liz Powers. I'm the co-founder and chief happiness spreader at Artlifting.
Best title ever.
I think they just chose me to be the MC today because of the title. So my background, the last 10 years, I've worked with homeless and disabled individuals. I've done casework, so working one-on-one, helping get food, housing, jobs, and also ran art therapy groups. Tons of clients during those meetings told me, Liz, everyone always focuses on the negative in me, of you're in a wheelchair, you're homeless, and they were defined by their circumstance. So I started a company called Artlifting, which combines the words art and uplifting, to help homeless and disabled artists from all across the country, instead of focus on the negative, focus on the positive, their amazing talents. So this piece behind me was created by a local artist named Alan Chamberlain, and he's a paper cut artist. So if you can believe it, all of the black is connected. He just used an X-Acto knife and one sheet of black paper to hand cut that.
It's amazing.
So Alan is so proud to say he now gets to pay taxes. He now has the honor of not having to only live on disability, but supplement his income. And his goal is to eventually completely get off disability. So with that thought of focusing on the positive, Sally is amazing at it. If any of you have seen her Twitter feed, there are a lot of haters out there. People who combine hateful, toxic words in ways that I could never possibly imagine. And Sally takes it with a grain of salt and continues to focus on the positive. So Sally Cohen's background is unbelievably impressive. She was considered one of the top 100 influential pundits on all of TV. She's a political commentator on CNN and The Daily Beast, and her writings have been featured in The New York Times, New York Magazine, RollingStone.com, and Elle.com. Her work has also been featured on The Colbert Report, The National Review, and her two TED Talks have a combined view of 2.5 million people. So if any of you, we were brainstorming today of how to get those numbers up, because they're not impressive enough. So if any of you haven't seen it, please watch them.
Alone, not with a friend. Watch it separately.
All right. So one of Sally's TED Talks is titled Emotional Correctness. And for those of you who haven't seen the TED Talk at all or seen it lately, wanted to share what that term means.
Well, thank you. First of all, can we give it up for Liz? I mean, this is really... The work you have made, the work of your life, is just so inspiring and impressive. And by the way, because you didn't mention it, I'm going to, that both of these pieces are for sale, and including prints of this piece, and you should all come up and see it afterwards and check it out close up. It's really remarkable, but the story behind the pieces is even more incredible, as are you. So this is exciting and a real honor for me. And it's great to be here with all of you. Hello. Hi. I did two TED Talks. One is on clickbait and how if we do not like the garbage on the internet, then we have to stop feeding it with our clicks. You can go find that one. And then the better, thank you, whoever agreed. I have a feeling a few more of you agree with the concept and just didn't clap. And the other is on this idea of emotional correctness, and it came out of my time. So I was a community organizer for 15 years before I made the move to doing media. It was not something I'd sought out. It was sort of something I stumbled into. I was speaking at a conference. This woman comes up to me and she says, "We have to get you on television." And I said, "No, we don't." because I was a community organizer, and community organizers are behind the scenes, and the whole like ethos of the job is you're putting the affected communities in front of the camera, and they're the ones in the spotlight, and you're just doing the grunt work behind the scenes. And so this was like not something I'd ever thought of for myself. And this woman grabbed me by the arm, and she said, no. I mean, literally grabbed me by the arm, not metaphorically, literally. Grabbed me by the arm and says, no, you're gonna do this, and you're gonna be good at it. Turns out her name was Geraldine Laybourne. She was the first woman ever to run a television network. She ran Nickelodeon, and then she and her friend Oprah started Oxygen. And so Jerry was not someone who took no for an answer, obviously. And she dragged me across the room. She said, this woman's gonna train you, and this woman's gonna mentor you, and I'm gonna help support you, and this is gonna happen. And it was one of those moments that really changes your life. And I realized after doing it for about a year, a little bit kicking and dragging my feet, I realized that I liked it. And in a lot of ways, being a talking head on television was a lot like being an organizer. I, got to help distill ideas and action and vision, but instead of doing it for like 100 people in a church basement, I got to do it for a million people on television. The same concept. And so about a year after that, through a strange turn of events, I ended up paid commentator on Fox News. Now, for those of you who don't know...
Perfect fit. Perfect
for
fit.
For those of you who don't know, I might have buried the lead on this one, but two things you should know about me when I say I worked as a commentator on Fox News. One is that I am a lefty. I am like to the left of the left. I am, a lefty. I'm a radical leftist, number one. Let's just be really clear about that. And then number two, again, for those who don't know, and I hope I don't shock anyone in the room, I'm gay. So... what this meant was that I was a openly gay lefty on Fox News, which was maybe pretty unique. And I had never watched Fox News. I had all these ideas in my head, right? Show of hands, who has only ever seen Fox News by the clips that get passed around on the internet or on, say, like The Daily Show? That was me. Right? That was me. So all my ideas of Fox News were through the lens of Jon Stewart and his team. And I love them, so it's fine. But like, I had a very sarcastic and sardonic perspective on the network. And I thought, oh my gosh, all these people are going to hate me, just like the right-wingers all hate me. And I had all these very, to be honest, hateful ideas in my head. Right? They hate me. I hate them. This is how this works. Welcome to America. And two things happened when I got to Fox News. First of all, I realized, hating the people who you are working with and trying to communicate to is pretty counterproductive, as well as corrosive, sort of spiritually. And second, I realized they didn't hate me. This was a real, can I say mind fuck? Is everybody gonna be offended? You okay, Liz? This is a real mind fuck
for me. I don't like swearing.
To go on Fox News and be like, oh my gosh, Sean Hannity, Mike Huckabee, like, they're nice people. Now, that doesn't mean I think they do nice things in the world. That doesn't mean I agree with all their ideas. I think their ideas are nice. But as human beings, they weren't, like, treating me in the way that I anticipated I would be treated, right? They were not manifesting the hate that I thought they felt toward me. And it made it feel pretty hypocritical for me then to be hateful, too. And it opened me up to the idea that, look, I quoted this in the speech last night, but one of my favorite intellectuals is a woman named Jean Hardesty, who's actually from Boston, who ran a great organization that still exists called Political Research Associates that studies the right wing in America. And she wrote a book called Mobilizing Resentment. If you want to understand how we got to this moment in history, it's a profound book to read. And she says, don't blame the leader. Don't blame the followers. Don't blame the followers. Blame the leaders. So here I was on Fox News with some of the leaders. And I was even finding that they were interpersonally nice to me. And I had to really reconcile that. I was like, okay, well, if that's true, then that must even be more so true of the followers, of the viewers, of the people who actually are wrestling with and not sure about these ideas and struggling with them and whatever. And that was a real turning point for me intellectually. So emotional correctness comes out of the idea that, look, it's different from political correctness, which, by the way, I'm happy to talk about this, I defend 100%, 1,000%, I think political correctness is important and essential to American democracy, and in fact is really just basic decency and dignity and kindness. That's really what we mean when we say political correctness. You should, it's the golden rule for the 21st century. But it's not enough. The words you use aren't everything. It's also about the tone, the way you say it, and really the emotional intent behind it. That I can, you know, call you a woman, or I can call you a woman, right? I mean, there's disdain, right? There's lack of respect, there's condescension, there's, and what I wanted to cultivate in myself and hopefully in others was a spirit of generosity, a spirit of believing the best intents in others until proven otherwise, trying to believe that you know, we have more in common than not, and to operate and act from that position in all the facets of my life, not just on Fox News. So that was really the idea behind emotional correctness.
And I think emotional correctness, you know, we would all, that's something we'd all love to have 100% of the time. But it's something that is easier said than done. So how do you actually implement this now that we've, you know, got this awesome definition, this goal?
So this is, it is what you said is exactly right. It's like all things in theory, right? It's like, I don't know if there are parents in the room, but in theory, I don't ever want to yell at my child. In practice, however. Right? So like in theory, when encountered with someone who I disagree with politically, I want to operate with this generousness of heart, and I don't want to get into, right into debate mode and argument and whatever. And in practice, it's everybody's go-to, right? Now, there's something you need to know about how the human brain works, right? We have different parts of the brain, and I can't tell you what they're called, but I know that they're there. And it's like the frontal lobe parts. The frontal lobe parts are the parts that are, you know, when we put little things, you're a doctor, when we put little things on our brains and do studies and watch where they light up, when we're engaged in persuasion or discussion or conversation, frontal lobe parts light up, the parts of the brain that are involved in reason, right? In decision making, in weighing pros and cons. When you start an argument, or when a person with little brainy things on watches an argument, suddenly those parts of the brain go dark, and the fight or flight parts of the brain light up. And suddenly it's pick a side. And spoiler alert, if most Fox News viewers are going to pick a side in the fight or flight mode, they ain't picking my side, right? So you have to find ways to keep it conversational. So that argumentative thing is not only for me kind of spiritually, morally not what I wanted to do in the world, but it's actually also counterproductive. It doesn't allow people to hear you. And you can make all the good points you want to make, but if people aren't hearing you, it's like a good point falling in a forest. So there is a great jujitsu trick that I am going to teach you. This is fantastic. It is wonderful if you can learn to do it in life. It works incredibly well. And by the way, it works well whether you're across the table from an uncle at Thanksgiving who you have real political disagreement with, or a subordinate or a coworker challenges you on something, and you're looking for a way to you're looking for a way to respond without just attacking, getting defensive, right? And here it is. The trick is ABC. So if I'm in a conversation with someone and they say, you know what, Sally, whatever you're saying, like that sounds really nice, I get it, we should treat people well, but you know, immigrants, these undocumented immigrants, if they were even being nice using the word undocumented, they're coming to this country, they're taking our jobs, and we can't even afford to have jobs for the people who are already here, and we can't, these lawbreakers, they have to get in line. This isn't fair, this isn't right. And my instinct is, no, you're wrong, and let me tell you why, and to make the argument and to make the case and whatever. And like I said, all that's going to happen is the persuasion's going to shut down, fight or flight's going to kick in, we're in an argument mode, it's unproductive. Instead, think about this idea, A, B, C. So A is affirm. The first thing you do is you affirm. Find something emotional usually, that you can authentically affirm. And that's the key, emotionally, authentically affirm. So it's not, you're right, immigrants are stealing our jobs. That's not it. And it might not even be, I may not agree about, a point, maybe they made something, a point about how America's changing too fast, and I don't agree with that, so I'm not going to agree with that. But I can agree that it's a really insecure time in our economy. I can agree it's a scary time to try and have a job, keep a job, make sure you make enough money to feed your family. I agree with that. I'm not bullshitting. I agree with that. And the thing about people's feelings, right, because underneath every political belief is an emotional belief. We usually adopt political beliefs to rationalize our emotional beliefs. That's how this works. And underneath every political belief is a feeling. And I will tell you right now, feelings are valid on their face. You cannot argue with people's feelings. I learned this in couples counseling. Everybody feeling me here? Because we got a couples counseling, and my partner, I love her, but my partner would, you know, I'd be like, honey, you hurt my feelings. She'd be like, no, I didn't.
No one can relate.
I'm over here, and in my reality, and nobody knows what I'm talking about, in my reality, I'm like, but they're hurt, right? I mean, your feelings are valid on their face, and so other people's feelings are valid on their face, and if you don't seem like you understand where they're coming from, you're dismissive of their feelings, they're going to dismiss everything you say thereafter, period. So if somebody is talking about, you know, look, I'm worried about, and I'm using perspectives that are obviously from my own political perspective, we can invert this, but if someone's saying, look, I don't want to let Muslims into this country, I'm really worried about terrorism, it just feels like we can't take the risk, underneath that, there's a feeling of fear. There's a feeling of fear about terrorism. I live in New York City, I get that. I think about it almost every time I ride the subway. That's real, that's not made up. Right? It's not just now the conclusion they draw with the feeling, that's politicized, but the feelings are real. So first of all, you affirm. The second thing you do is you bridge. B, the B is bridge. The B is not but. You do not say but, as in, I know I'm really concerned about security too, but. Because again, going back to couples counseling, this is what we learned in couples counseling. If you say, honey, I'm really sorry, but, it means I'm not sorry at all, actually. Everything that came before the but, I did not mean. You also cannot use however, which is the Harvard of buts. Right? Okay. Although, yeah. I think that's the Wellesley of buts. All right. But you use a bridging phrase. And is always a good one. The good news is, that's why. Here's the thing even works, right? You cut the but out and you put in a bridging phrase. And then the C is actually convinced. The C is where you get to what you wanted to say in the first place. So I agree, this is a really tough time to be trying to get a job in this economy, a job that pays well, that feeds your family. And that's why we need to raise the floor for all workers in our country, because we know that when and big employers can undercut jobs and undercut wages, it actually hurts all wage. It all hurts all wage workers. And did you know there's this study and blah, blah, blah? And then I'm off to what I wanted to say. But the person I'm talking to now thinks we have this common cause, as opposed to I'm saying, no, you're wrong, I'm right. That's a horrible way to begin a discussion. No, you're not going to, nobody's going to, who wants to be told they're wrong? Right? Again, going back to couples counseling, three sexiest words of the English language. Does anybody know what they are? You were right. Three sexiest words in the English language. There you have it. Everybody likes to hear they were right. It feels good. And so starting by affirming, starting by validating, and then bridging, and then going to what you wanted to say, that ABC, affirm, bridge, convince, that is the practical strategy for, at least the way I've found, is the best way to get around this.
So last night, Sally spoke about how we live in a time where obviously the country is incredibly divided, but we still have to have compassion, and we still have to work really hard for the concept of love trumps hate. And I think it's really true for both sides. You know, there's clear misunderstandings, there's clear anger, either way. But one thing that I think would be helpful for the audience to know is, well, how exactly do you start having that compassion? Like, one thing I'm personally guilty of is I live in my little bubble. All of my friends have very similar political beliefs to me. So as was extremely apparent during this election was, well, there's lots of people who live in bubbles who don't necessarily interact with the other side.
Yeah.
So how do we start implementing this compassion and at the next election cycle be more together and united as a country?
So I do think part of it is this tactical strategy, this ABC, is from an operational standpoint. And then what I will say is that for me, it gets paired with a kind of moral philosophy. And this is hard stuff. I don't think this is easy. I don't think this is easy in our moment in time. I do think it's potentially revolutionary if we can do it, which is to believe and actually practice the kind of compassion and inclusion and love for people who disagree with us that we want them to be practicing for the communities that we're supposedly standing up for. So in this election, and the way it plays out for me is, look, I was one of those people on your TV who said, oh my gosh, but Trump he's a misogynist, and he's attacking communities of color, and he's insulting Muslims, and he's insulting Mexicans, and he's doing all these things, and he's sowing hate and division in our country, and that's bad. And the challenge, right, the paradox, is to be very careful to not say, and I hate him for that. And I hate people supporting him for that. Because you're trying to solve hate with hate. When the hell has that ever worked? Right? And it's hypocritical. Frankly, it's hypocritical. I talked last night about going to, you know, some of the marches. I live in New York. I went to some of the marches right after Trump was elected, and you'd see people holding their Love Trump Hate sign, and they'd be saying, we hate Trump. New York hates Trump. It's like, do you see the irony here, right? And the simple fact is, from my perspective as a leftist, that I know that a lot of the driving energy behind the other half of the country and how it voted was not necessarily because of overt support for the things he said on, you know, Access Hollywood or the things he said about Mexican, but it was a sense that they're left out of the country. And that as the country moves to more reflect the values and culture of people like me, that they're not only left out, but they're disdained. That basically, people like me don't like them. Right? And that's a real tough one to wrap your head around. You're like, wait a second. Like, we're just asking you to treat all these other people equally, but there's a way in which that conversation is just, it hasn't happened in a way that makes clear to people that they are not being left out. And that's not, by the way, our fault. That's actually, I would argue, the right's fault. That's the message that they've been told for 50 years, is that, look, progress for women and people of color and immigrants comes at your expense. Mm-hmm. Comes at your expense. And so then when they feel any hint of elite New York, California disdain or contempt, they put it onto that framework and say, oh, okay. So not only are you taking my jobs, are you taking my language, are you taking my public schools, are you taking my taxes, but you're also kind of taking my soul. You don't value me as much. And that dynamic, look, I'm still gonna fight for all of the social safety net programs and ideas of political correctness and inclusion, but I can do so in a way that makes clear to people, at a moral level, like, yes, we all win. We all win when this happens, and you are loved and equal too. And this is not a contest. This is not a contest about who's going to be more loved in America. This is not a contest about who's going to be more included in America. This is us all working to continue to perfect the idea of this country that we have slowly but surely progressed toward, of us all being included, of us all being equal. We need to make that case in a way that makes everyone feel that they're a part of that.
Thank you. I think that deserves a round of applause.
I mean, you could boo if you wanted.
So shifting gears a bit, one topic we wanted to cover today was thinking about peer pressure. It's not something that just applies to teenagers. It's something that we all experience as adults as well. So what advice do you have for the whole audience here of when they're experiencing peer pressure of, you know, being forced to act a certain way or lean a certain way? How should they react?
I don't have an answer, so I'm going to have to be honest.
I should have prepared her.
Unlike the rest of everything I've said, which was a giant pack of lies, let me tell you. We all know which clip of this is going to end up on Twitter later. Sally Cohn, liar! There's always a push and pull between authenticity and effectiveness. That's it. That is the, as far as I'm concerned, and the more and more I've been in the public eye, you tend to feel that more, but I think that's true, that, you know, that's been true throughout my life, and I think that's true in everyone's life, that you're always wrestling with, you know, you want to, and again, it goes back to couples counseling, right? You want to, like, I'm angry and I want to express myself and I want to just be able to say what I'm feeling, and ooh, that might not go over so well if I say that. Like, this is gonna blow into something, and their feelings are gonna get hurt, and you can't undo it, and right, and you're always wrestling with those tensions, right? When I want to yell at my kid, because I just do, that's how I'm feeling authentically in the moment, and I know it's probably not the thing I should say to her, because parents don't talk that way to their children, or at least they shouldn't. And I have to remind myself of that. And so you're always walking that balance, that tightrope between those two ideas of sort of effectiveness and authenticity or self-expression. What I will say is, for me, has always been a helpful framework, right? Because, okay, so you're always walking that, and you have your own internal monologue about where you think is the right balance. And it's different for everyone. And it probably is different moment to moment, right? You're a little bit more your authentic self, I hope, at home, I hope, than you are at work, right? Within that, then there's this other dynamic of peer pressure. And peer pressure can be your friends, it can be your personal relationships, but now increasingly, unfortunately, it's also the internet. It's also the Twitter and the social media, and right, and depending on how public-facing your job is, there may be other, not only your colleagues, your superiors, your clients, but there's also other kind of, there may be other public-facing entities that are kind of giving you peer pressure feedback. And I will say the thing that I've found the most useful for trying to weigh and balance all of this is something that a friend of mine, Anne Friedman, developed. You can Google this and look it up. Anne Friedman's a brilliant writer based in Los Angeles, has a fantastic podcast with Amina Tusao called Call Your Girlfriend, which you should all listen to. And she came up with this thing called the Disapproval Matrix. And it's a grid like this. And on the one hand, the one axis is how well you know these people, strangers to friends or loved ones. And the other is negative to positive. And what if you go and look at this, and we should have a visual, but we don't, so whatever, you're just gonna have to friggin' picture it. but what she does, the important distinguishing between is critics and haters. Critics are people who know you and respect you, but are saying something negative. Haters are strangers who do not respect you, right? Who do not even maybe like you and are saying something negative. And being able, and I gotta tell you, every time I get off air, that's a tough one for me. Because I get off CNN, I'll go on CNN, I'll have some conversation about who's you, what's he, I'll make this face or that face, and I can't help it, it's just my face. And I try to sometimes, but even then, people are like, your face. And I was like, but I was trying. It's not, whatever. It's what I got to work with. It's mine. Anyway. And I'll get all these comments, and some of them are positive, and the positive ones, you're like, yes, thank you, I'll take all those, and then you see the negative ones. You get the emails and the whatever, and some of them are obvious trolls. And I do have, I have to brag for a second, some of the best trolls on the internet. They are really special snowflakes. They are creative. They have a thin grasp of grammar, but are very metaphorically creative. I gotta give them credit for that. So those are easy. I can ignore them or sometimes repost them just for fun. And also because I do actually think it's important for people to know, especially people who don't experience these things, to actually have a sense of what women, queer folks, experience by being in public. I think people need to know that. That's easy. And then there are people who I know and respect who might drop me an email or tweet and offer constructive criticism. That's easy. And then there's this big space in the middle. And part of when you're in any kind of public-facing situation at work, in your community, or in the public eye, you're balancing and trying to have to decide moment to moment who's a critic, who's a hater. And can I take the constructive criticism in a way that makes me better, more effective, and not be defensive, but not actually swallow, ingest, embrace the hate. Because the way to think about the difference is the critics actually have your best interest at heart. The critics want you to succeed. They want you to do better, and they're trying to be helpful. And the haters just want to take you down. They do not, so their advice is not helpful to you. It is not advice. It is wishful thinking. They want to destroy you. And to figure out a way to balance those two things is the sort of public optic to that kind of internal balancing act you have to do.
So as a heads up, we're going to start Q&A after one more question, so you can get ready. We've got lots of microphones. The last question is, you know, right back at the theme of today, optimism. So you're clearly an optimistic person, but have you always been an optimist?
So here's something interesting. I struggle with optimism. I am not an inherently optimistic person, and I haven't always been for most of my life. I'm actually what I would call a cynical optimist. So I'm aspirationally optimistic, but practically deeply, deeply cynical, right? So I don't, you know, I don't know where the balance sort of falls. Does that make me? Because I'm not a pessimist. Because I wouldn't do what I do if I was a pessimist, right? Like I have to believe that. Sometimes cliches are right. I have to believe that that long arc of history does bend toward justice. I don't think it bends on its own. We have to pull it, push it, and yank on it, make it bend. But if I didn't believe it would ultimately happen, right? I've spent my career working on, poverty rights and healthcare reform and women's rights and LGBT rights and criminal justice reform. And if I didn't believe that those things could change and get better, I wouldn't be doing what I was doing. Mm-hmm. I'd be curled in a corner in the fetal position like I have been for the last few weeks. But anyway, so fundamentally there has to be an optimism. And at the same time, I'm maybe the term is a realist or something, but I see the tremendous obstacles that we have to racial, social, economic, political justice in our country that we have had for 200 plus years that continue to plague us. And I do think that, again, you know, all of this is to have, at the end of the day, it's about a balance. And it's about seeing the challenges, the injustices, the obstacles to equality and fairness and opportunity in America, seeing them for what they are, and also having that hope that they can get better, both of which are informed by history. We can see how dark things were in the past and how they did get better. Not all better, not 100% perfect, but better. And we know that that can happen again and again and again. But to know that it takes all of us and it takes our investment in it getting better. So somewhere in there, I try to find optimism, because what's the alternative? For me, anyway, there's no alternative. I wouldn't be doing this anymore. I'd go become an apple farmer, and I'm really not sure I'd be a good apple farmer because I don't like manual labor. So, I'm really stuck here, and I just don't want us as a people, as a country, to be stuck here. So I try to believe. Right? It's a little bit of the twist on Gandhi. It's not just be the change you want to see in the world. It's also believe in the change you want to see in the world. We can't be effective change advocates. Mm-hmm. If we don't believe it's possible, if we ourselves don't believe it's possible.
Thank you. Would love to hear from the audience in terms of questions. Just laying the ground rules, really.
Thank you.
Laying the ground rules, being the bad cop, please make sure to keep your questions short. I think we've all been to conferences before when someone asks a question, which is really a 10-paragraph
comment. We're going to know if it's not
comment.
A question. So
keep the question short, and we're excited to hear from you.
Heyo.
Hello. Oh, it works. Good. Sally, dead on and funny, and I really appreciate
thanks.
That. Obviously, if we're in this room, we've come here for a reason. So you talked a lot about the tips vocally. Sometimes mentally, to put it out there. What would you advise in that moment to talk ourselves off of the anger ledge? Words, a mantra, to get us back to sleep at night, because some things doesn't feel right. So what do you do, other than alcohol maybe?
But, I was going to say, alcohol and good drugs are really... I'm not going to say I took one of my dog's Xanax, but I might have thought about it. Not confessing to anything here. Don't friggin' tweet that. In this particular moment, I'm not gonna lie, this is hard. Like, in this, for me, it is hard. I am very proud that I got through last night's speech without just breaking down crying. This is a hard moment. It is, and to be honest, look, I try to stay away from anger. I felt angry for a little while there, and I have had moments in my life where I feel angry. I try to instead feel sad. I feel like if you're going to feel a negative emotion, sad is a more constructive one, because it leaves you in a more open-hearted and connecting kind of way. So at the very least, I try to be okay with that. And to be honest, that requires a lot of vulnerability, especially publicly, right? Anger is strong. Anger is aggressive and, you know, focused on other. And the sad is yourself, and the sad is vulnerable. And the sad has a level of honesty to it that I think anger doesn't have, and opens up the possibility for being more constructive. So at a starting level, right before you can even get to implementing some of the tools, I do think thinking about and being willing to be just sad in this moment or whatever, depending on how you're feeling, is a good start. Yeah. It's you!
I'm next. Okay. Hi.
Let's hear from the left side of the room. Left side of the room. Showing up.
So I'm still in college and like grew up with social media. It's like my life.
Oh, sorry.
Might have it tattooed on me. But basically, you were talking about the difference between criticism and just haters. Have you found, like, through your extensive, I'm sure, like in your career, you have to use social media in many ways. Have you found that you're able to like get meaningful criticism out of social media? And like, if not, why do you think that's not happening? If so, how is it happening?
I'm, again, not gonna lie, I have found social media more helpful in the past sometimes than I do in the present, especially Twitter. Once upon a time, Twitter was more of a kind of constructive engagement platform. It was a really nice way to connect with people, and it is now, for me, certainly, because of my time at Fox News, you know, you don't spend 2.5 years as a lefty lesbian on Fox News and not pick up a nice collection of trolls. So it is, you know, that has definitely shaped my experience with social media. I now have trolls on Instagram. Let me just tell you, trolls on Instagram are like, what are you doing? Like, at least on Twitter, you can be kind of anonymous. Trolls on Instagram, you click through, I'm like, there's your kids, I see you. That's just wrong, right? The best was, every once in a while, I'll know that during the election, I would know that I got like trolled or posted about on 4chan or Stormfront or one of the really, you know, sort of extremely nasty dark corners of the internet. Because suddenly my Instagram, I mean, Twitter, whatever, it would just get a little worse because it's always bad. But my Instagram feed would suddenly be filled with MAGA, 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 make America great again, hashtag MAGA, 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 MAGA. And to the point where like I would post a picture of my dog at the dog park and it would be MAGA, 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 MAGA. And then they'd be like, MAGA, but your dog is really cute. MAGA, 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 MAGA. Right? All right. So anyway, so I have to be honest, increasingly I don't find it helpful. I do find, I hope that other people's feeds are not as bad as mine, to be honest, so that you can find some space, and it can be a useful sounding board, right, for ways, what I do find Twitter very useful is to ways to sort of encapsulate and messages and ideas and test them and see how they resonate. It is still very useful for that, obviously, in addition to being a distribution platform. But truth is, I think about quitting at least easily once a week. This is why I'm not going to be in any advertisements for Twitter anytime soon. But it's a mixed bag. It's tough. But we also all have to make it, part of my TED Talk is we have to make it a better platform by behaving better ourselves and setting a good example for others. And I do try so hard to do that. But I have a lot of draft mean tweets. You know, I just like write them cathartically and then I don't post them. So that helps. Hey, right side! Woo!
Hi, Sally. Thank you for speaking with us. Okay, so while I feel like I'm pretty grateful to be innately optimistic, one type of person I just really, really struggle with is the condescending person whose goal isn't even to be right, it's just to make sure you feel bad about yourself and to make sure you feel wrong. I have one specifically in mind at work. She was here today. And
oh, I would talk to her.
He's the worst.
We can connect them.
That'd be great. And I'm just wondering if you've ever worked with or been around any just incredibly condescending people and how you deal with that without losing your optimism, but, you know, kind of sticking it to them at the same time.
Yeah. It sucks. So, I mean, part of it is just to, like, validate the, like, the suckiness of that kind of experience. It sucks. And I've had it happen on air. And it, you know, I've had people, you know, hang on, dearie, or, you know, well, you don't know what you're talking about, or, you know, and it's one thing to be have someone be condescending in a private situation. It's another thing to watch someone be condescending in a you know, where a couple million people are watching. That's really unsettling. I will say, look, depending on the relationship, you can or cannot obviously challenge a person's sort of behavior. But the key thing is, first of all, I would recommend, number one is I'd recommend my friend Jess Bennett's book, Feminist Fight Club. She spoke last night. If folks missed her, it's for sale down at the bookstore. You should get the book. She actually has some great, you know, strategies, tactics for how you handle all of these, you know, mansplaining and the man-terrupter. She has a better term, bro-appropriation, all of these different. She's brilliant. Very useful. I do think this is where tone, I will say tone matters here. And at least for me, right, when I'm in the public eye and someone is being condescending, you can't flinch. This is where you can't show vulnerability or weakness. If you show that you, in any way, shape, or form, that it gets to you, and I mean even just like a little micro flinch, then the whole room and that person know that it's working. And this is where, at the very least, like cultivating a more of a warrior kind of mentality, a happy warrior mentality, and not projecting any sensitivity to that is going to be very effective. Thank you.
The middle.
Oh, I better answer faster. Okay. Right. Yeah.
No, you partly answered my question already. You
know. Oh, because, great! Fantastic. Because, thanks for being here.
Because.
Sorry, I'm kidding. I'm just teasing. Go ahead. No, go on.
Because I believe in love, you know, but as women, you have to be careful about when you show you're vulnerable. Mm-hmm. You know, this business of, you know, when to make excuses for people. You know, oh, well, they treated me like crap, but, you know, they have a lot of stress. And that's what I'd like you to make, well, you started to make clear here, but also to make clear again, when do you want to do that trying to empathize with another person, and when is that, especially if they're in power over you, when is not that's not the right way to go?
So there's a profound difference between empathizing with someone and apologizing for them. So I'm going to empathize for people who have political views that are different than mine. I'm going to try to understand them. I'm going to try to make that connection so that we can have a conversation. I'm not going to apologize. I'm not going to make excuses for them. I'm not going to defend those positions. I will defend their humanity, their basic dignity. That's where we are connecting. When I empathize, I'm connecting at that level. But I'm never apologizing, whether it's for, you know, some extreme anti-immigrant position or the way someone treated me interpersonally. I'm not apologizing for or making excuses for that. I think that's a profoundly important distinction. And yes, look, as women, we could just do an hour just on this, but look, we all have different sides of ourselves. And those interact with or come up against how society perceives us. And certainly the way society perceives women is gendered. But then within that, everybody has their own particular varietal or phenotype, right? So I'm a 6'1" butch dyke. I don't have to worry about coming off as too soft and vulnerable. You know what I mean?
Oh, I don't know.
I can get away with a fair amount of that, whereas I do have to worry coming off too aggressive and whatever. And so I'm going to have to, while being true to myself, right? Everybody has different facets of themselves. I'm going to, you know, I may dial up a little this or a little of that, depending on the situation. And that's going to be different for everyone. So yes, it's not, unfortunately, sexism is a one-size-fits-all reality, but the way it sort of manifests and interfaces with other dynamics of your personality, your persona, as well as race and class and sexuality, these are all going to be different for everyone.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Hi. Uh-oh, closer to the mic.
I can't hear you.
There we go.
This mic expects.
I want to hear the part where you say you really like what I was saying.
Okay.
I want to make sure everybody can hear it, all right? You know? It's fine. Yeah.
I really liked what you had to say about political positions often being kind of a justification for an emotional reaction that you're already having. But I think one of the things that I feel like the reactionary right has done really well is emotionally weaponizing factual words. And so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you get to this C in the ABC when the thing that you need to talk about that people have already been trained to feel as in a personal offense. So where, like, the thing that you need to talk about, you have, by using the word assault, the person already feels like you're attacking them or whatever the word is that you need to use.
I mean, this is absent of doing specific, workshopping specific examples, this is a judgment call each time, and it has to do with who you're talking to. The way you might talk about issues of sexual assault or consent, I'm just kind of riffing off of what you said, the way you might talk about issues of sexual consent, sexual assault or consent, or even rape, are going to vary based on how you're thinking about who you're talking to. It might vary whether you're talking to a young person or an older person, a man or a woman, a straight person or a queer person. So on some level, that's always the case. Look, none of this is to say sacrifice your values and your beliefs. You believe what you believe. This is a communications principle. You believe what you believe, right? Whether it's you're selling your new invention or you're trying to sell an idea in the public marketplace, you believe what you believe. That doesn't change. You don't change that for anyone. The way you talk about what you believe probably could and should change depending on your audience. And so you may use words that you know are less triggering. You may use examples or stories that you know are going to resonate better, right? If I'm talking to a group of moms, I want to talk about some issue of public policy, I'm going to bring up stories about my daughter, right? And I would say that as a general rule is that stories are always useful. We're a story-based culture. All cultures actually in the world relate and tell history and pass history through stories. And so we can connect at a level of story, and people will remember your story even if they don't remember the argument or the point you tried to make. So yeah, of course it's going to change. Again, it's your argument is similar to you. You're going to have these different facets that you choose to present and portray to be your most effective as well as authentic. Hello.
Need to make this short enough for me. Okay.
Somebody recently used this. I didn't say short. They said vertically efficient. I like that.
Nice.
You're vertically efficient.
I have not heard that before. I will use that.
It's good.
So there's a thing that I've been seeing a lot of lately. I think we all have this. Oh, Trump won. I'm moving to Canada. Let's flee the red states. Let's avoid family, holiday dinners, so we don't have to talk to those people. And I'm sort of wondering if you think it might be more productive to stay in those situations, to go to the red states, to go to the family dinners and engage rather than just sort of fleeing to the bubble where we feel comfortable, and try to, okay.
Yes. I mean, first of all, a lot of people who live in the blue states came from red states. So there's a bit of a false dichotomy of all of this. But look, I understand why people for their own sense of sanity might feel like they just need to take a little break for a few months. Like this was a tough one to digest. But I don't think fleeing is the answer. I don't think isolating ourselves from the conversation. And to be honest, this is where this gets very interesting. If you're the kind of person, by and large, if you're the kind of person who has the ability, the inclination to think about fleeing, you're exactly the kind of person who needs to stay. Because the people who would want to flee, who should flee, the immigrants, Muslim communities, trans folks, folks who are going to be most affected by the kinds of decisions our electorate just made, can't flee. They can't flee. Poor people, right? They can't flee. So if you have the wherewithal to be able to flee, you're probably the person who needs to stay. You're probably the person who has the most access to and social capital with the kinds of communities and constituencies that need to be having these heart-to-heart conversations. Not just for the next 4 years, but the next 40 years, the next 400 years. So I think it's important we think about that. Great question. Thank you. Yeah.
One problem that I think women can really relate to, all women.
Women only have one problem?
One problem, just
right,
one
cool.
I'm talking about.
We've made progress, everyone. We've made progress. We've got it down to one problem. All right.
That's minimalization.
What now?
Minimalized.
Oh.
In your workplace or
yes.
In your family or among, your community. And minimalization, I have come across, is pretty debilitating at the time
yeah.
that it happens. And I'm wondering if You know, we can approach things in a joke. We can approach things, you know, in an empathetic way, different. How do you approach that particular problem when it's directed at you?
Yeah. I have to say, personally, I tend to not think about problems. I just think about reality. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, I have lived a very wonderful gay life. It has only ever been a good thing for me to be gay. I have been fortunate enough to have supportive parents, supportive community. It's only ever been a positive in my life, and I consider myself fortunate that I can then be in the public eye and be an example to the Fox News viewers, now the CNN viewers, who maybe don't know a gay person, and be a role model to young gay people and gay people in more challenging situations around the country and the world. I could look at that as a challenge. I really could. I could look at the hate tweets and the, you know, obstacles and the inequality, and I could focus on all that. And I do, to the extent that I still work. I'm not naive about those, and I still work to change them and transform them. But I also see the opportunity for leadership and power. And I think that's true with gender. I think that's true with race, is that you can do both. You can do this kind of personal jujitsu where you are focused on structural inequality and social inequality that is real and is serious and we need to address and we need to talk about, and see yourself as a vessel of change and hope and inspiration and power, that's reminding people that that's the case and this is also true. I can also be strong. I can also be inspiring. I can also be positive. I can also be all the good things too. And you start to show, again, you're being the change you want to see in the world. You're believing in the change you want to see in the world, that we can walk and chew gum at the same time, right? That we can be those kinds of inspiring, optimistic, hopeful, positive, loving, generous, kind, good things, while also fighting against all that is bad and wrong and negative and unjust. Those two things are not in tension. I actually think that we need to do both in order to change anything.
Just keep going at it.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, thank you all so much. Unfortunately,
we
ran out of time.
Can't keep going.
But thank you, Sally, for being such a leader.
Thank you. Great questions, everyone. Thank you.